Making Sense of the Digital Society. A podcast with answers to the big questions of digitalization. For everyone who wants to be in the know about the many debates. But we are not only trying to make sense of the digital society, we are also demystifying some of its buzzwords. Making Sense of the Digital Society is also a series of live lectures in Berlin that I have moderated since early 2018. My name is Tobi Müller, and I am the presenter of this podcast. We cover a wide range of questions, such as, how do we want to actively shape a digital world? How can these processes be aligned with public interest? What kind of knowledge do we need for this? What are the underlying changes in society beyond the hype over new technological developments? What is power in the digital society and how is it distributed? Do services fueled by algorithms and artificial intelligence improve our lives or do they enforce social inequalities? And what role do cities play in this transformation, like infrastructure and public goods? We combine summaries from the lecture series Making Sense of the Digital Society and conversations with international experts. You will hear renowned scientists talk about their research and discuss key issues. Their topics are diverse. Complex problems need attention from various disciplines in order to come closer to an understanding of the time we live in now and want to live in tomorrow. When we talk about change, we don't just talk about technology, of course. We also talk about social institutions and how they are affected by digital change. In this episode, we therefore explore changes in democracy and the notion of the public in a digital society. Two modern institutions were considered the most important link between citizens and the political systems: political parties and professional media, at least until recently. Both institutions stand for the smooth functioning of representative democracy, which is why Jan Werner Müller calls them the critical infrastructure of democracy. Today, both intermediary institutions, political parties and professional media, are subject to major structural changes, although it is difficult to grasp and name these changes. Jan Werner Müller offers such an account. In the following lecture, which was held in March 2021, as part of the Making Sense lecture series, Jan Werner Müller proposes normative criteria to assess how well the intermediary forces are functioning. Jan Werner Müller is a professor at Princeton University in New Jersey, where he teaches political theory and the history of political thought. He is the author of several books which have been translated into numerous languages and are considered central to understanding contemporary political developments. His latest title fits like hand and glove with this episode of our podcast, Democracy Rules. Here's an edit of Jan Werner Müller's talk at our lecture series.
I guess, ladies and gentlemen, it's become a commonplace that opinion about the internet in general and social media in particular has swung wildly from one extreme to the other in the last decade or so. From a view according to which the revolution wasn't going to be televised after all, instead it was going to be tweeted during, as you all remember, the Arab Spring, to the view widespread today, as a distinguished colleague in history put it recently, that Facebook equals fascism. This wild swing from one extreme to the other might be an indication of the fact that we have just been inventing golden ages, that we don't have our history as far as media is concerned, right? Or it might be an indication that we lack normative criteria for really judging the development of media, or, to invoke a classic work in this area, a structural transformation of the public sphere. What I would like to offer you tonight is a reconstruction of the two institutions that were indeed considered to be absolutely indispensable for the proper functioning of representative democracy ever since the 19th century, namely political parties and professional media, to offer you in the first chapter of my talk a brief reminder of why people thought this, and in particular, which three functions observers consider to be absolutely central as far as these intermediary institutions were concerned for democracy. In the second chapter of my talk tonight, I want to suggest to you three normative criteria for how to judge the quality of such institutions. This is by no means an exhaustive list, in particular, and I'll flag it right away, in particular, the very contested question of whether such institutions should be accurate, should be sticking to some form of the truth, etc., I will leave aside for the moment. Allow me perhaps one brief footnote about the particular title of tonight's talk. Why critical infrastructure? I mean infrastructure in a very basic way. I'm really talking about what it means for people to reach others and to be reached. So infrastructure, for instance, in the sense of public transportation. But maybe less obviously, what I'm also trying to allude to is the fact that for citizens in a democracy to make proper use of their basic political rights, such as free speech and free assembly, to name just two obvious ones, one needs organizations. It's one thing to be demonstrating all by oneself on a big street. It's one thing to be, let's say, sending chain emails to one's family, one's friends, unsuspecting strangers. It's another thing to use established intermediary institutions to multiply one's views, to multiply whatever one thinks one has to say in the democracy. That's a specific sense in which I'm using infrastructure for the purpose of tonight's talk. All right, on to my first chapter. Three central functions of so-called intermediary powers and political parties and professional media in particular. First, and maybe rather obvious, these institutions offer representations of society to society itself. And in particular, they structure ongoing conflicts and cleavages in a society. They offer what Pierre Bourdieu once called a vision of divisions. Rather than representation being a kind of mechanical reproduction of something that is already there, be it interests or ideas or even identities for that matter, we should rather think of representation as a dynamic process where all kinds of actors, but in particular political parties, whose traditional job it has been, but also to some degree professional media, essentially offer to a potential constituency a conception of their identities, their interests, or whatever else it might be that these self-selected representatives think has not really been represented yet. All of which, ladies and gentlemen, should be fairly obvious in the case of political parties. It might be somewhat less obvious for the case of professional media, who, after all, when they offer some form of political coverage, simply tend to follow what political parties are already doing, what they're saying about themselves, and what they're saying about society. But it's not always the case. After all, it used to be fairly normal. In fact, sometimes still is the case, that professional media themselves start certain campaigns, for instance, on the basis of investigative journalism, where media also say, look, here's a problem that hasn't really been understood. Here's a constituency that hasn't really been represented. Here's a form of discontent that hasn't been properly articulated in what Bourdieu called a vision of divisions. So the first point is about structuring representations. Second point is about both external and internal pluralism. External pluralism, I think, should be fairly obvious. No such thing as a democracy without party pluralism, but also no such thing as a democracy without media pluralism. Internal pluralism is a somewhat less obvious and maybe more contentious demand. In the case of parties, those countries which essentially say, look, A party has to have internal structures to allow deliberation, to allow conflict. It can't be a kind of one-person show, even though, as some of you are probably well aware, this exists as well. Some countries, some democracies, have a massive problem with this kind of approach. In fact, they wouldn't even allow parties like this. Germany is one obvious example. It's one country that in its constitution basically prescribes an internal pluralism for political parties. Why? Because the thought is partly that a party that is autocratic on the inside is also much more likely to be autocratic on the outside, or to go down some kind of authoritarian path if it ever gets into power. Less obviously, and on a more normative note, I would add that internal processes of party democracy fulfill the important task of habituating people to disagreement, even disagreement on the basis of shared principles. Because obviously parties have programs, they function on the basis of ideas and principles that people share, but principles never somehow implement themselves. They always need to be debated, they need to be argued over, people have different views about this, and yes, it's true that all of that can sometimes be very annoying, very tiring. Some of you may remember Oscar Wilde's famous quip that the problem with socialism was that it took too many evenings. So far, parties and their internal procedures. What about media? It's much more difficult. Some countries, again, Germany is a good example, actually, in their legal systems, also tend to exempt media from a certain degree of internal pluralism. They consider them what is locally called Tendenzbetriebe, which means that, for instance, workers don't get the same amount of power and representation that they would get in a different kind of enterprise, let's say a car factory, because the thought is that the media is perhaps dedicated to particular ideals which should not be subverted by those who work on the inside. Let me add one more word about something that perhaps is also not exactly very obvious when it comes to intermediary powers and their functions. What I'm talking about as a third function is the need to structure political time. Parties do this arguably in the same way that democracy at large does it. There are set moments, there are focal points, if you like, when citizens ought to pay attention, when it's election time, when it's campaign time, when an important decision is about to be made. With the media, I think the function as far as structuring time is concerned is a little bit different. So Adorno, for instance, already held in his famous essay about television as an ideology that the kind of cultic element of television, some of us may remember those days when the whole family gathered around the 8 o'clock news, that was already disappearing, that this sort of linkage to older notions of rituals was no longer quite there. But it seems self-evident that nowadays, in an age of seemingly total availability of news, not just around the clock, but absolutely everywhere, of not being tied to a particular place, this ritualistic function of intermediary powers might be something that we've perhaps lost conclusively. More on this in just a few minutes. Allow me, first of all, to open my second chapter and very briefly suggest to you a number of normative criteria of how to judge the quality of such intermediary institutions, partly in light of the functions which I've already outlined in the first chapter. First, and maybe rather obvious again, it matters whether intermediary powers are, broadly speaking, accessible. Whether you can join a party, whether you have access to media as a consumer, but perhaps even somehow as a producer. Secondly, it seems to me a plausible criterion to say that such institutions have to be autonomous, by which I don't mean that they somehow have to be impartial, that goes without saying, in the case of political parties. In the case of media, There's nothing wrong, I think, with media even being partial or partisan, as long as everything is out in the open and you know that you get, let's say, a distinctly conservative view on the world. All I'm flagging to you is that you can be partial and openly partisan, even as media. What matters more is whether you are autonomous or whether there are hidden powers, whether you are, for instance, the plaything or the front of a particular business in a nefarious way. Example, many of you will remember Silvio Berlusconi's party Forza Italia, which is, of course, still around, which was more or less created by marketing experts, which more or less functioned like a fan club for a soccer/football team, and, one might be forgiven for thinking, which was basically just a tool for the Cavaliere to stay out of prison and to pursue his personal interests by other means. This, ladies and gentlemen, is what I'm trying to get at when I talk about the need for autonomy. Intermediary institutions should not be the tools or the fronts of something else that is invisible or maybe just barely visible. Thirdly, and this to some degree sums up the two criteria I've already given you, such institutions also need to be what the British philosopher Honora O'Neill has called accessible, by which she means these institutions should be transparent enough such that those who look at them can at least get a rough sense of who owns them, who's behind them, how decisions are made. It's basically a kind of good enough criterion such that one would say, okay, there are certain things I won't know, but I know enough to understand who's responsible, where people are coming from, and also if there are any complaints or concerns, I know who to turn to. For now, allow me to open the third and last chapter, which, as promised, concerns the much-debated world of social media. Allow me two very quick preliminary observations as far as this debate about social media is concerned. I think some of our colleagues are right to say that by now this has generated what they call a moral panic, by which they mean that certain particular, seemingly self-evident phenomena, such as disinformation, the spreading, sometimes viral spreading, of fake news, extremism, etc., have become so seemingly obvious that all the attention is there. But the important point is that an exclusive and somewhat panicked focus on these phenomena might distract proper attention from much larger and, in a certain way, more important structural transformations. If all one cares about is the latest extremist tweet, one might, for instance, not pay sufficient attention to the de facto death of local journalism in many parts of the world. Arguably a much more important phenomena than isolated individuals indulging in lying, in fake news, etc., etc. So I think that's an important preliminary remark to make. The second preliminary remark that I wish to offer you is to say at least one word about where social media might be located within this larger conceptual frame I was trying to offer you at the beginning when I was talking about critical infrastructure. But the way I would put it is to say that at the bottom, so to speak, of a proper understanding of where to locate social media would be good old physical infrastructure. So we tend to think of the internet as wireless, but of course, you know, we're still de facto looking at actual cables, fiber optics, and so on and so forth. None of that, as many people have rightly pointed out, means that this kind of physical infrastructure is somehow neutral or that there aren't important choices that have been made about how to lay out this infrastructure. But still, this is still primarily about technology. So with this very rough, very crude tableau in place, allow me to say just a couple of words about where social media might come out in a very broad sense in light of the criteria I was trying to make plausible to you just a few minutes ago. Accessible? Well, on one level, of course, individually very easily accessible. But systemically and institutionally, of course, almost impossible to access. In the case of social media, as everybody knows, the monopoly power of the institutions makes it virtually impossible at this point for new competitors to enter at the systemic level. Secondly, as far as autonomy is concerned, you might again say, well, it's kind of a mixed bag. On the one hand, with many of them, you might say, well, it's not obvious that one would think that they are really just the fronts or the more or less nefarious tools of hidden interests. At the same time, as everybody also knows, you might say they're not truly autonomous as institutions, because at least some of them are literally controlled by one individual. And if the core normative intuition behind autonomy is that you don't want to be at the arbitrary will of powerful actors, then social media on this score clearly come out pretty badly. Thirdly and lastly, accessibility. Well, I'm going to tell you things that you already know. As ordinary citizens, as ordinary users, we of course will find it virtually impossible to understand proprietary algorithms. We will also find it extremely difficult to properly grasp the underlying business models, perhaps especially those which essentially try to maximize engagement partly through revving up emotions, riling up people, making them angry, and so on and so forth, because these are, for the most part, black boxes. Yes, it's true, more media literacy would help. According to some surveys, only about 29% of Americans and British citizens understand that something like their Facebook newsfeed has something to do with an algorithm and isn't just somehow objectively the news as such. But even if we became better able to read some of these phenomena, there's a hell of a lot that we wouldn't be able to truly understand. So as, for instance, the scholar Erica Kish has put it, we're a little bit like in the Middle Ages, when some people could actually read the Bible and some people could only look at the pictures. And everybody understood something about what was going on in the Bible, but the difference was clearly very vast. At least to me, as somebody who, as you may have become painfully aware by now, who is not at the center of some of these discussions, who doesn't study social media from any sort of empirical, maybe even not even conceptual point of view, remains a question to what extent the question that Walter Benjamin famously asked and then answered about film has yet truly been answered about social media. Remember that Benjamin, in his famous essay about art in the age of mechanical reproduction, essentially said that the new apparatus of filmmaking kind of tested people and selected people for particular abilities. There was this famous point where he said, look, the parliaments are emptying out, the theaters are emptying out, this apparatus is essentially replacing the old-style parliamentary politician by the dictator, and it's replacing the old-style theatrical actor by the movie star. Now, for some of you, that might seem like it's a technological determinism. There might be a lot more leeway. But of course, there have been plenty of observers who in recent years have been tempted by the thought that, for instance, Twitter itself might somehow be, as some people have put it explicitly, an authoritarian medium, or even somehow a populist medium, whatever that might mean exactly.
Following Jan Werner Müller's examination of how a different party and media landscape affects the public, in the upcoming conversation we will hear how social media has been used to undermine democratic processes. Social media platforms and messaging services can no longer be separated from the political reality. Among other things, the spread of disinformation has a strong influence on the politics of our world today. The presidential elections in Brazil in 2018 are just one prominent example of the extent to which the spread of information in the digital world has had a massive impact on political events. In the same year in India, fake news has led to striking violence. And in Myanmar, Facebook has been used as a tool of the military to aid in the so-called ethnic cleansing of thousands. In the United States, of course, disinformation continues to be a highly controversial issue on a number of social media platforms. Stay with us for Amelie Held, who speaks with Clara Iglesias Keller about the regulation of fake news in times of election campaigns, focusing on France and the United States. Amelie Held and Clara Iglesias Keller are both lawyers and associated researchers at Humboldt Institute for Internet and Society, HIG. The conversation was recorded in November 2018, shortly after Jair Bolsonaro was elected as president of Brazil.
So in our series today, we are going to talk about fake news. So as a brief introduction, my name is Emily. I've studied law in France and Germany. I'm now working as a researcher at the Hans Bredow Institute in Hamburg and at the Humboldt Institute for Internet and Society. That's where we are today. So my research field is the transformation of public communication. To be more specific, I work on questions regarding freedom of speech in the digital sphere. So that includes algorithms and opinion formation, datafication of journalism, artificial intelligence and content moderation, including upload filters. And that leads me to the topic of our talk today, the so-called fake news regulation and political micro-targeting. For this purpose, I've been looking at a French law project that is about false information in election campaign periods. And that has been quite discussed in, on the international level because more and more countries are facing this problem of information manipulation. So we're going to talk about that later, about this specific project. But now I would like to introduce our guest today, Clara. Welcome, Clara.
Thank you.
Clara Keller is a guest researcher here at the Humboldt Institute for Internet and Society. She's visiting from Brazil. And could you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your research?
Yes, thank you so much, Emily. Thank you for having me here today for this talk. As you pointed out, I have been a visiting researcher here at the HIAG since June now, and I'm here to write my PhD thesis and do some research on the national regulations of online service providers, but very much focused on Brazil and also considering internet governance principles. In a nutshell, what I'm trying to do is to identify which regulatory techniques and processes lead to results that better suit internet's peculiarities, like technical characteristics, political arrangements, and everything. But I do work on some other things as well. I'm actually a lawyer with a background in media, IT, and communications regulation. I have two masters in this field. I have worked for corporations, NGOs, and I have spent a considerable amount of time working for the Brazilian Audiovisual Regulatory Authority. So I also do some work on constitutional law, democratic institutions. So it gets pretty clear where my interest in fake news comes from, you know, joining all these research interests. But I actually think it's kind of hard to be from Brazil right now and not be interested in fake news, considering what just happened in our elections. Or maybe that's something that is happening everywhere, I guess. You know, so maybe it's hard to be from anywhere and not be interested in fake news right now.
Yeah, definitely. So from what I understood, it's also a research interest that has come within the past years for you?
Well, as something that I have been actively studying, I would say it was mostly fired up by the election process. It started around May or June this year when, you know, the whole public debate in Brazil was already concerned with what would happen with the elections. Mm. We had already seen what happened in the U.S., you know, with Trump's election, and we had seen what had happened in Brexit already here in Europe. And we were expecting this to be a challenging election, mostly because of artificial intelligence manipulation of information. And it totally lived up to it. because that's exactly what happened. And considering the studies that I had been doing already, I started getting asked to do some talks or interviews or writing papers. And that's how I inevitably, I would say, ended up studying this furthermore.
From what you just described, it was a quite similar process for me because I have lived and studied in France and therefore also studied or followed the French elections last year very closely. And since President Macron was also subject to manipulation of information or at least rumors that have been propagated about him during this election time, the French lawmakers started a law project against false information in election times. And that includes actually the implementation of two old laws that had already been there before. So these two laws were designed for the analog world, let's say. And what the new law project is trying to do is to bring those laws into the digital sphere. So I think it shows quite well that it's a problem that has already been there before. It's just that with the technologies of today, we're just facing new challenges and everything just gets so much faster and maybe also more difficult to really identify where the false information or the manipulation is coming from. So that's the French case I've been looking at. And now what would be very interesting is to hear, like, in light of the recent elections you have already mentioned in Brazil, what is the situation over there and what are the regulatory projects?
Well, I think you make some very good points when you talk about the French experience. I always like to start talking about fake news by saying that lying is not illegal, and it hasn't been for a long time, and so that people have always lied and manipulated information. And except for the cases where the law tells you that this is illegal and it already provides for remedies like libel, slander, or privacy breaches, if not for those cases, you don't have pretty much of regulation of this lying or something that forbids you from manipulating information. If you think about it, media regulation institutions have been trying to deal with this for a long time, with assuring that the public debate, that the public sphere will be minimally fair and impartial and participative and open. So let's say that the main issue here is not something that has never been addressed or object of study or worry. So what is new now, as you properly mentioned, is the use of technology to create this artificial echo. If you think about it, it's natural and expected from the democratic process that whatever is going on in the public debate is echoed in the results of elections or referendums or whatever, you know. But what bothers us now is that there's this artificial echo being created with the automated spread of one single message that most of the time is a fake message. So we end up with this feeling that our elections results were affected by an artificial echo, by an artificial message, you know, because it's not necessarily what is coming from most of the citizens. It's not necessarily a natural debate that is happening. And we get this feeling that this should not be treated as, you know, as we have treated manipulation of information so far. And I think that is the right thing to feel. You know, I don't think both phenomena should be treated equal in democracies. What I think happened in Brazil in the last elections, I mean, what has been reported so far, is that the fake news strategy of the campaign of the elected president was very much based on WhatsApp. You know, as we know, there are several different ways of using technology to disrupt and manipulate information. You can use algorithm curation. You can use bots to replicate messages. You can do political micro-targeting. Or, you know, nowadays, these tools to manipulate videos and news reporting and everything, they're getting more and more efficient. So there's like different ways of messing this up, I would say. But what happened in Brazil right now, what has been reported to have happened, is that the winning campaign basically used the software to harvest from Facebook people's phone numbers. Only from those users who have inserted their phone numbers in their Facebook profiles as public information. So the software harvested those numbers and created like hundreds of thousands of WhatsApp groups. And through one centralized content production source, it started spreading those fake news through WhatsApp. So what some users report is that they one day saw them their cell phone numbers added to this WhatsApp group, many of them with foreign numbers, numbers from the US, numbers from India, numbers from places they didn't even recognize. And then they just started spreading that message. And immediately some people would leave the groups, but some people would identify with those messages and stay, and then just start forwarding those messages to other groups. And apparently that is how these fake news started circulating.
So could the users see who created the group? I mean, you can see a number, but could you identify where the information was coming from?
No, they just identified these numbers that were many times foreign, sometimes from Brazil. And, you know, whoever was not comfortable with those messages just left the groups, you know, but people who identified minimally stayed and started getting their content and spreading it out. Yeah, and it's, of course, the fake news strategy, the information manipulation strategy is never based on one thing. You know, this is what was reported so far that we know that happened. And of course, it was just one part of the strategy. You know, political campaigns nowadays, they consider social media in a much broader sense. So, for instance, it is possible to identify a little bit of an information chaos within the campaign, as in somebody from the campaign would tell you something, and then later on, somebody else would say the opposite thing. And then at the end of the day, the then candidate, now elected president, would come and pacify the discourse, you know, as the savior of the whole information mass. So you and I, we had a chance to talk about this once, but it's, I always think this is a good example mentioning. Around June this year, a Supreme Court Justice of Brazil actually made a declaration saying that if the results of the elections were proven to be influenced by fake news, the whole thing could be annulled. You know, and there's just so much complexity to this statement. And it seems such a, like such an unfair simplification of the issue, you know, because in order to actually annul an election or any other democratic process result, it has to be so clear. It has to be so mathematically proven that that result is illegitimate. You know, but how would you do that? How would you say that because of this piece of fake ad, somebody or how many people exactly voted in a certain way? And how are you going to prove that that was not the way they would have voted anyway at first?
And this without affecting their privacy, because I mean,
exactly,
the choice to vote for a party for another is a very private subject to privacy and secrecy. So I think that's not something we can really, how can we measure that? And I'm happy you mentioned this anecdote, because I was going to ask, how can we really enforce this type of regulation? If we look at laws against information manipulation, how can we really prove that people are, well, maybe propagating false information? This we can show, but the effects that they really have on election results, I mean, can we really measure that?
Yeah, and I don't know. I'm not even sure that we should look at final results. When you're talking about how to regulate these things or how to deal with them, I'm not even sure we should be looking at the results phase. I think we should take a step back and maybe look at previous arrangements. Well, when we're talking about information, we are always talking about a conflict between a certain value and freedom of expression. No, and another issue that we have here is that most of the technological mechanisms that are used to regulate information, they also impose several risks to freedom of information online. This is something that you usually write about. Right, Emily?
Yeah, well, that's, I think the big problem here is always the balancing. The tools we can use in order to protect freedom of information are in order to protect privacy. They can either way also be used to restrict freedom of speech. So it's very hard to find the perfect solution here. However, taking a step back, as you said, the measures that we could use are the first thing that comes to my mind when we talk about false information dissemination or disinformation is countermeasures such as counter speech. I'm not very convinced of that, and it's not a regulatory tool, but a lot of scholars have been saying that counter speech, in this case, it would be better and more factual information could be something that helps. So as long as you have good information sources and free media, that can already be a tool against this type of private WhatsApp groups or other type of ads that lead to an information that is based on other groups. I mean, not coming from classical media.
Yeah, alternative sources.
Yeah.
Yeah. But actually, it is always fair to say that classical and traditional media also have played an important part, you know, because now they have all this fact-checking duties. Oh, of course, they already had them. But now with fake news, you have seen so many websites with traditional and new media, you know, just gathering efforts to try to find out what was fake and what was real. And if you think about it, this is also part of the strategy that I told you, you know, because you throw all this fake information out there, and instead of people having more time to look into your actual proposals and everything, everybody's just trying to figure out what's truth and what's not. You know, this is actually a very good strategy, you know, if you want to keep your main agenda out of the public debate, you know, just throw all this fake information out there. But anyway, I think I lost track a little bit here. Speaking about countermeasures, this is obviously an exercise, but I would say a few things. I would say that it has to be multidisciplinary. I would say that a merely legal approach is never going to be enough, because this is a multidisciplinary phenomena. You know, it's about democratic institutions, it's about the law, but it's also about sociology, it's about politics, and it's also about psychology, you know, with all these mechanisms of reinforcement, not to mention technology. So first, I would say this is not a job only for lawyers, for certain. And I would also say it's a job for several different agents, you know, and this, what I just really reported here is a good example of that. You know, during the campaign, Facebook was taking down fake profiles. Traditional media and new media gathered efforts to do some fact checking. Civil society was organizing counter speech. People were going out in the streets to through human contact and through human talk, trying to tell other people, especially the ones that were not sure yet about how to vote. So this is the kind of countermeasure that...
That is not only regulatory. I mean, that
it's
is...
not only regulatory.
Exactly.
Yes. And of course, there's also a duty for regulators here. You know, what is it exactly? It's something that we had to find out with time. But for instance, another that interesting thing to think about is if we have such a hard time balancing other values with freedom of expression without restricting it, you know, maybe we can look at other fields. For instance, data protection. Last week, we were talking a lot about data protection in Brazil here, especially because of how these elections played. This thing with harvesting data considered to be publicly accessible, it really gives you an idea of that maybe things are not that simple, you know, because if you think about it, we do have a data protection law. It was not enforced yet when the whole elections things happened. But even if it was, it wouldn't have been enough, because the kind of data that they used is not considered sensitive data or data that is actually protected. It was just publicly available data, you know. So is that enough? You know, when you go to Facebook and you put up your profile and you say, okay, you can use my phone number. Did you actually mean that people could take your phone number, put you in a WhatsApp group and start sending fake news? I don't think so.
It's the same. It has been the same with Cambridge Analytica, playing a game on Facebook, giving your data to, or at least your public information to an app. Is that enough for you to consent to giving not only your data, but also the one of your friends? And what type of consent are we talking about here?
Yeah.
So that is one of the big questions in data protection law. And I think, when we talk about fake news in election times or disinformation, we tend to think more of political rights in the sense that voting or media freedom, yes, and freedom of speech are concerned, then again, everything that has led to those disinformation campaigns has been the data that was somehow available on the internet, and in both cases available via Facebook. So I think that data protection is a good path to take here, and there's more research to be done when it comes to what is really public, what is sensitive, and what is really the consent of a user.
For an even deeper dive into the topic of fake news, also check out Christoph Neuberger's lecture Democracy and the Public Sphere, which he gave as part of the Making Sense of the Digital Society lecture series. As professor of communication science, Christoph Neuberger recapitulates in his talk the developments in the change of social communication. What happens to our core democratic values such as freedom, equality, and truth in the digital society? Are we living in times that strengthen democracy by expanding participation, or are we rather experiencing the demise of democracy through fragmentation and acceleration? All materials mentioned in this podcast and a large number of other interesting resources can be found at hiig.de/making-sense and bpb.de/digital-society, in one word. Making Sense of the Digital Society is a production of the Alexander von Humboldt Institute for Internet and Society and the Federal Agency for Civic Education. My name is Toby Müller, and I hope you have enjoyed this podcast. Editing and production, Christian Grauvogel and Philine Janus. Executive Producer, Christian Grauvogel. Sound design and recording, Juri Bader.